And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, I found out some interesting things this morning. If you're retired military, you can go to the local military hospital. I know here, the local military hospital is giving the COVID shots. So is the VA, if you have an appointment. They just dropped the age where they're going to give the shots to 65 and above, or over 18 if you have certain underlying conditions. So, if you're looking for a shot and you're retired military, you might check out your local There we go. Local military hospital. Never know what you might find out. All right. Today is February the 18th, 49th day of the year. During the 16 days remain till the year is over with. On this date in 1229, the Sixth Crusade. Frederick II, the Holy Roman Emperor, signed a 10-year-old truce with Al-Kamil, regaining Jerusalem, Nazareth, and Bethlehem, with neither military engagements nor support from the papacy. Remember, in those days, the Pope had his own army. 1268, the Battle of the Weizenberg is fought between the Livonian Order and Davmana Pasov. 1332, Amdasayan I, Emperor of Ethiopia, begins his campaigns in the southern Muslim provinces. At one point in time, Ethiopia was quite a powerful kingdom, apparently. 1478, George, Duke of Clarence, convicted of treason against his older brother, Edward IV of England. And for his pains, he was executed in private at the Tower of London. That'd teach him to annoy his brother. 1637, 80 Years' War. Off the coast of Cornwall, England, a Spanish fleet intercepts an important Anglo-Dutch merchant convoy of 44 vessels escorted by six warships. They destroyed or captured 20 of them. That wasn't good. 1735, the ballad opera called Flora, or Hob in the Well, went down in history as the first opera of any kind to be produced in North America. Took place in Charleston, South Carolina. 1781, the Fourth Anglo-Dutch War. Captain Thomas Shirley opens his expedition against Dutch colonial outposts on the Gold Coast of Africa. That was in present-day Ghana. 1791, Congress passes a law admitting the state of Vermont to the Union, effective March 4th. After that state had existed for 14 years as the de facto independent, largely unrecognized state. Still unrecognized today. 1797, French Revolutionary War. Sir Ralph Abercrombie and a fleet of 18 British warships invade Trinidad. 1814, Napoleonic War. The Battle of Montereau. 1861, Montgomery, Alabama. Jefferson Davis is inaugurated as provisional president of the Confederate States of America. 1861, with Italian unification almost complete, Victor Emmanuel II of Piedmont, Savoy, and Sardinia assumes the title of King of Italy. 1873, Bulgarian revolutionary leader Vasil Levski is executed by hanging in Sofia by the Ottoman authorities. They took a very dim view of folks that annoyed them. 1878, John Tunstall is murdered by outlaw Jesse Evans, and that sparked the Lincoln County War in Lincoln County, New Mexico. 1885, Adventures of Huckleberry Finn by Mark Twain is published in the U.S. 1900, the Second Boer War. Imperial forces suffer their worst single-day loss of life on Bloody Sunday. That's the first day of the Battle of Paardeberg. 1906, Edouard De La Vallee forms the Belgian Olympic Committee in Brussels. 1911, the first official flight with airmail takes place from Allahabad, United Provinces, British India, when Henri Priquet, a 23-year-old pilot, delivers 6,500 letters to Naini, which is about 6.2 miles away from where he started. But still, it was the first official flight. 1930. While studying photographs taken in January, Clyde Tombaugh discovers Pluto. 1930. Elm Farm Ollie becomes the first cow to fly out a fixed-wing aircraft. It's also the first cow to be milked in an aircraft. I wonder if that's the cow that got thrown over the moon. Oh, I'm sorry, that cow jumped over the moon. 1932. The Empire of Japan creates independent state of Manzhougou. That's the obsolete Chinese name for Manchuria. It was free from the Republic of China and installed former Chinese Emperor Eisen Gioro Pui as chief executive of the state. 1938, Second Sino-Japanese War. During the Nanking Massacre, the Nanking Safety Zone International Committee is renamed Nanking International Rescue Committee, and the safety zone in place for refugees falls apart. 1942, Imperial Japanese Army begins its systematic extermination of perceived hostile elements among the Chinese in Singapore. It was probably the entire Chinese population, but that's just between you and me. 1943, the Nazis arrest the members of the White Rose Movement. It was a nonviolent intellectual resistance group in Nazi Germany led by students from the University of Munich. The group conducted an anonymous leaflet and graffiti campaign that called for the active opposition to the Nazi regime. And Hitler took a very dim view of that. 1943, Joseph Goebbels delivers his Sportpalast speech. 1946, sailors of the Royal Indian Navy mutiny in Bombay Harbor. And from there, the action spreads throughout the provinces of British India. Eventually involved 78 ships, 20 shore establishments, and 20,000 sailors. 1947, the First Indochina War. France gains complete control of Hanoi after forcing the Viet Minh to withdraw to the mountains. 1954, First Church of Scientology is established in Los Angeles. 1955, Operation Teapot. The Teapot test shot WASP is successfully detonated at the Nevada test site, has a yield of 1.2 kilotons. WASP is the first of 14 shots in the Teapot series. 1957, Kenyan rebel leader Dedan Kimathi is executed by the British colonial government. Also in 57, Walter James Bolton becomes the last person legally executed in New Zealand. I like that, legally executed. 1965, the Gambia becomes independent from the United Kingdom. 1970, the Chicago Seven are found not guilty, conspired, and incite riots in the 1968 Democratic National Convention. It came out at some point that the FBI actually had undercover agents inciting riots at the 68 convention. 1972, the California Supreme Court, in the case of People v. Anderson, invalidates the state's death penalty and commutes the sentences of all death row inmates to life imprisonment. 1977, the Space Shuttle Enterprise test vehicle is carried on its maiden flight on top of a Boeing 747. 1979, Richard Petty wins the then-record 6th Daytona 500. After leaders Donnie Allison and Cale Yarborough crash on the final lap of the first NASCAR race televised live flag to flag. 1983, 13 people die and one is seriously injured in the Wami massacre in Seattle. It's the largest robbery-motivated mass murder in U.S. history. 1991, the IRA explodes bombs in the early morning at Paddington Station and Victoria Station in London. 2001, FBI agent Robert Hansen is arrested for spying for the Soviet Union. He's ultimately convicted and sentenced to life imprisonment. 2001, the Sampit conflict, inter-ethnic violence between Dayaks and Madurais break out in Sampit Central, Kalimantan, and Indonesia. Ultimately, it results in more than 500 deaths and 100,000 Madurais displaced from their home. 2003, nearly 200 people died in the Daegu subway fire in South Korea. 2004, up to 295 people, including almost 200 rescue workers, died near Nishapur in Iran when a runaway freight train carrying sulfur, petrol, and fertilizer catches fire and explodes. 2007, Samjawata Express bombings occurred around midnight in Diwana near the Indian city of Panipat. That's 50 miles north of New Delhi, India. In 2010, WikiLeaks publishes the first of hundreds of thousands of classified documents disclosed by the soldier now known as Chelsea Manning. 2013, armed robbers steal a haul of diamonds worth $50 million during a raid at the Brussels airport in Belgium. And in 2014, at least 76 people are killed and hundreds are injured in clashes between riot police and demonstrators in Kyiv, Ukraine. A lot of births and deaths on this date in history. Holidays and observances. Christian feast days. Bernadette Soubirous in France. Comet of Lindisfarne. Flavian of Constantinople. Geltrude Comensoli, Simeon of Jerusalem in Western Christianity, Dialect Day in the Amani Islands in Japan, Independence Day, which celebrates the independence of Gambia from the UK in 1965, Kurdish Students Union Day in Iraqi Kurdistan, National Democracy Day, celebrates the 1951 overthrow of the Rana Dynasty in Nepal. And in Iceland, we have Wife's Day, or also known as Konadagur. Let's see what else we have. In 3102 BC, the origin of the Kali Yuga. In 1268, the Livonian Brothers of the Sword are defeated by Davmana Pasav in the Battle of Rakovor. When I talked about the Duke of Clarence being privately executed in the Tower of London for treason against his older brother. This was in 1478. He was supposedly drowned in a butt of Malmsey wine. That's an interesting way to go. 1503, Henry Tudor, who became Henry VIII, created the Prince of Wales, the title. 1519, Hernan Cortez leaves Cuba for the Yucatan Peninsula in Mexico. He has 11 ships and 500 men. And he took over and destroyed a couple of societies. 1536, France and Turkey signed a military trade agreement against King Karel. 1563, Huguenot Jean Paltrot de Mire shoots General Francois de Guise. 1573, Zeeland falls to Dutch rebels. 1634, Ferdinand II, Holy Roman Emperor, orders Commander Albrecht von Wallenstein, a general and a nobleman, executed. 1678, John Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress is published in Holborn, London by Nathaniel Ponder. And having been forced to study that in school, I wish Ponder had done something else with his time. 1685, Fort St. Louis is established by a Frenchman at Matagorda Bay, and this forms the basis for France's claim to Texas. Certain parts of it they can have. 1688, Quakers conduct their first formal protest about slavery in Germantown, Pennsylvania. 1713, the French invade under Jacques Cassard on Curaçao. 1745, British pretender, The pretender to the British throne, Bonnie Prince Charlie's troops occupy Inverness in Scotland. 1787, Holy Roman Emperor Joseph II bans children under 8 from having to work. 1797, Trinidad surrendered to a British fleet under the command of Sir Ralph Abercrombie. 1804, the first U.S. land-grant college, Ohio University, in Athens, is chartered. 1828, more than 100 vessels are destroyed during a massive storm at Gibraltar. 1839, the Detroit Boat Club is formed, still exists today. 1849, the first regular steamboat service to California starts. 1850, on this date, the California legislature creates 9 Bay Area counties. 1856, the American Party, known as the Know-Nothings, which is kind of like our Congress right now, convenes in Philadelphia, nominates his first presidential candidate, former President Millard Fillmore. He was the 13th president. 1857, Chinese residents in the fledgling state of Sarawak rebel against the White Raja, as he was called, James Brooke. 1865, the Battle of Fort Moultrie, South Carolina, takes place. It's won by the Federals. 1865, the Confederates evacuate Charleston, South Carolina. Also in 1865, Union troops force Confederates to abandon Fort Anderson, North Carolina. 1876, the establishment of a direct telegraph link between Britain and New Zealand. 1879, the Arabs capture Egyptian Premier Nabar Pasha. 1879, sculptor Frederick Auguste Bartholdi is awarded a patent for his design for the Statue of Liberty, which is actually the goddess of reason, according to the French. 1884, on this date, General Charles Gordon arrives at Khartoum. 1891, Captain Archinard's army fights with the Yamina of Niger in West Sudan. 1900, British troops occupy Monte Cristo and Natal. 1908, the first U.S. postage stamps and rolls are issued on this date. 1908, the American ambassador to Japan is given a note by the Japanese in which they agree to restrict Japanese immigration to the U.S. This was called the Gentleman's Agreement. And finally, in 1913, the French modernist painting Nude Descending a Staircase by Marcel Duchamp causes a major uproar when shown in New York. Because we all know that folks were born with clothes on. All right. We've been talking about creatures of the night, such as the werecats. Well, let's talk about giant spiders. Now, for a lot of the human population, spiders provokes a sense of creepiness and dread. And for people that have arachnophobia, it can cause outright terror. And that's often with an encounter with a small spider. So think then about encountering a spider the size of a dog. And you think that couldn't happen, but having seen some myself, I assure you it can. For decades, accounts have surfaced about giant-sized spiders that can easily rival anything thought up by the world of Hollywood. Now, the largest known spider is the South American bird-eating spider that goes by the name of Theraphosa blandi. One particular specimen, a 12-year-old by the name of Rosie, has an impressive leg span of just under 12 inches, making her the largest living spider on record ever. Now, that doesn't mean that nothing bigger than Rosie exists. It just simply means we haven't formally classified it. There are more than a few people who claim to see things bigger than Rosie. In 2001, English cryptozoologist Dr. Carl Shuker heard a fascinating story from an explorer by the name of Bill Gibbons. Gibbons spent a great deal of time investigating reports of the Congo's most famous monster, the long-necked Moki Mabimbi. That's the Congo's version of Nessie. Story goes back to 1938, and reports brought back by a pair of explorers, Reginald and Marguerite Lloyd. While negotiating a jungle pathway in the heart of the Belgian Congo, they saw something strange step out in front of them. Now, they thought it was a small crouching person, or maybe a monkey was crouched down. But they realized that they weren't looking at either one. They were looking at a gigantic spider that had legs that spanned 4 feet. Now, Reginald Lloyd, realizing the enormity of the situation and not stopping to think about the enormity of the creature, quickly reached for his camera. Unfortunately, the creature raced across the track and vanished into the undergrowth before he could get it on film. Now, the couple had no doubt about what they'd seen, though. A truly giant, eight-limb monstrosity. Now, the amazing account of the Lloyds doesn't stand alone. The local Baka Pygmy people have long-standing stories about these Goliath spiders, which are said to be far fewer today than they once were, although reportedly one of their tribespeople saw such a terrifying thing in 2003. Well, as for the lairs of these creatures, the Baka maintain they create something akin to huts, which are fashioned out of leaves and vegetation. And they're said to be skilled weavers of massive thick webs that they use to ensnare their prey that include anything up to about the size of a small antelope. And as I said, I think yesterday, we once had one of our APCs delayed by a spider web that was just huge, and it crossed a trail and that we were trying to get down in the jungle. We broke through it, of course. I mean, it's hard to stop a 2-ton vehicle, but it did slow it down. Almost brought it to a stop. Moving on to the U.S., there's a 1948 report of William Sladen, his wife and grandchildren. That somewhat echoes the report coming out of the Congo. Locations, Leesville, Louisiana. The family was walking to a nearby church for an evening of worship and prayer when their journey was interrupted in a bit of a horrific fashion.
As they strolled along the road, to their horror, a giant spider, described as being the size of a wash tub, came out of a nearby ditch and ran across the road. Well, after that, the family didn't walk that particular stretch of Louisiana road at night. Now let's go to Papua New Guinea for our next story. From there, we've got a story told by Debbie and Peter Hines, noted Australian cryptozoologist, which came from the father of one of Debbie Hines' friends. He was a man who had a bone-chilling encounter with a massive spider while serving in Papua New Guinea with the Australian military during World War II. According to the story, one day he had to take himself off into the scrub to answer a call of nature. And while thus engaged, he noticed he was crouched down next to a very large cobweb. Now, not the classic fishnet sort, but the fine, snow-white, cottony stuff that spread all over the ground and the tree trunk and everything in the area. His eyes followed it one way and then the other. It was rather extensive, like 10 to 15 feet out of the way. And then he noticed the spider itself only a foot or so away from his face. He described it as a real horror. The body, which is the thorax and the abdomen, he describes the size of a small dog or a puppy. Said it was jet black in color. The legs were thick and hairy, but not as long as the classic dinner plate tarantula-type spider that owes its size to the spread of its legs. This thing, he said, had more body bulk than it did spread. Needless to say, he backed out of there slowly and carefully. According to Dr. Carl Schuker, this is not the only report of a giant mystery spider encountered in Papua New Guinea during World War II. During an interview with cryptozoologist Rob Morphy of AmericanMonsters.com on the U.S. radio show Coast to Coast, a couple of years ago, a telephone caller named Craig recounted how his grandfather, while serving in Papua New Guinea during World War II, encountered a monstrous spider in a web that scared him so much he hacked it to death with his machete. According to Craig's grandfather, the spider measured an immense 3 feet from tip to tip and unexpectedly was not hairy like many big spiders are. Instead, it was shiny and was emerald green in color. This particular nightmarish arachnid was encountered near Port Moresby, the capital of Papua New Guinea. Now, it is possible that the southwest region of the U.S. is home to giant-sized insects that feed upon the human race. Such a thing sounds somewhat unlikely and incredible, but just like the kind of scenario presented in the classic 1954 sci-fi movie Them, Them is a movie in which a massive radioactive ants terrorize and slaughter the people of a small New Mexico town and threaten to do likewise to not just the rest of the country, but to the entire planet as well. Now, this brings us to an interesting question. Might truth be stranger than fiction? Danielle B. is a woman who for a number of years lived in the New Mexican town of Aztec, which, just like the far more famous New Mexican town of Roswell, had a crashed UFO legend attached to it. In fact, I wrote about it in a book called Beyond Roswell. And the legend about this UFO dates back to March 1948, when a near-intact flying saucer and its crew of diminutive dead pilots were found. But according to Danielle, she encountered something far stranger to Aztec than deceased extraterrestrial dwarfs and a wrecked flying saucer. It was on one particular day in May of 2004 when she decided to spend a few hours hanging out at Aztec's Heart Canyon, which, curiously enough, is exactly where the alleged UFO is said to have fallen to Earth back in the 40s. It's also where she had an encounter with something far worse than aliens. She said it was a warm and sunny day. She found a nice place to sit so she could read a book and have her snacks and drinks close to hand. Perfect way to spend a day off of work. At least it was for a while. For a couple of hours, she said all was normal until she noticed a small black helicopter approaching her in the distance. Far more correctly, she assumed it was a helicopter. Curiously, at a distance, that's what it appeared to be. But it was no normal helicopter. There was no thud-thud sound that one associates with the fast-moving blades of a helicopter. And on top of that, it appeared to be carrying something below it, like a small calf held tightly in place by thick ropes. Now, this was certainly not the type of thing you see every day. When the helicopter got close to Heart Canyon, though, she could see it was actually nothing of the sort. It was a large, obscene-looking insect of about 4 meters in length. What she thought were rotor blades were actually the fast-beating wings of the creature. And as for the ropes, they were nothing less than powerful-looking black limbs. Now, she could only stare in a mixture of awe, fascination, fear, and terror. As the huge creature flew overhead, dropped the calf and on a nearby peak, and then swooped to the ground with frightening speed and pounced on it and tore into it with its jaws. It took less than half an hour before the giant insect was done feasting and took back to the skies. Now, she had been too shocked to flee the area at the time, the result of which was that the terrible event was forever embedded in her memory, even though she certainly wishes this was not the case. Suspecting, maybe correctly, that she told local law enforcement officials what she saw, she'd likely be booked for wasting police time, or at least accused of being on drugs. Finally made her way home, stayed silent on the matter until she confided to a few folks later on. And even the strongest believers in the strange and the unusual have to admit her story stretches credibility to the max, despite the fact she came across as nothing less than absolutely credible, down-to-earth, and normal. And while many might be inclined to dismiss this as a bizarre account, not because in X-File style I want to believe, but because something very different. It might come as a surprise to a lot of people to learn that in a distant past, huge insects, not unlike the one she described, really did exist in this particular area. In the Jurassic period, there existed in what's today the United States a dragonfly called Meganeura manyi. Now, this was no regular dragonfly, though. It had a wingspan in excess of 3 feet. As another example, in 2001, Ohio State University geologists discovered the fossilized remains of a centipede in an old mine. The centipede was 5 feet long. Then there were the ancient remains of a sea scorpion found in a German quarry in 2007. It was an arthropod. Sea scorpion is of the same group as insects and spiders. There was something very notable about this particular sea scorpion. It was slightly more than 8 feet in length. Of course, none of these oversized things were alive at the time of their discovery. Instead, they lived and walked and flew millions of years ago, but it's certainly feasible in certain parts of the U.S. and amid a great deal of stealth and maybe underground caves and caverns that similar things may exist today. Now, a large segment of the population would deny it, but if you ask Danielle and people in her similar position, you'll get a different response. To this very day, she has no doubt these things are all too real. And in fact, she's writing a book about it now. It's a book that ties to the predations of these hideous things with the so-called cattle mutilation phenomena, which has plagued and puzzled ranchers, police officers, even the FBI for decades. Particularly so in the Southwest. According to her, the cattle mutilators are not satanic cults. Aliens are covert military units conducting biological warfare operations. They're actually giant creatures from eras long ago who are feeding on the nation's cattle herds late at night. And certainly that does make a great deal of sense. You know, maybe one day her story will be vindicated. And if that happens, let's hope it's not because the huge insects have decided to turn their predatory attentions toward the rest of the human race. The possibility of the scenario in the movie Them may one day become reality, rather than the stuff of science fiction. I mean, the very concept is kind of disheartening to consider. Well, in 1899, a decidedly curious creature was encountered in Alaska by a man by the name of Alfred Dominey and a friend named Weyherick. It was a terrifying, shape-shifting nightmare that's become known as the Indian Devil. Now, Dominey, a resident of Los Angeles, California, told his story to the press, which was all too keen to publish his saga of the sinister kind. And according to the newspaper story, in the spring of 1899, he and his partner were going up the Francis River when they came across an animal that apparently had been drowned and left by high water on a gravel bar. About the size and shape of a small bear. Weighed in at about 300 pounds. It was snow white. Hair about the same length and thickness as a bear. Short stubbed tail. Heavy neck. Head, teeth, and ears like a wolf. Short legs, not over a foot in length. And feet and claws like a large dog or a wolf. The two of them examined it thoroughly, but they couldn't determine what it was. But he was satisfied there are still living specimens of this same creature further to the north. Following the winter, while hunting near the lower end of McPherson Lake, he came upon a queer fresh track that crossed the trail where he'd been not an hour before. Now, the snow was deep, and owing to the animal's short legs, it was dragging its body through the snow. Satisfying himself, it was the same kind of animal he found dead further south, and being on a good pair of snowshoes, and this animal having to plow through the snow, he thought it an easy task to overtake and capture what he called the snow plow. He found it could plow snow and then beat him. After following it the entire length of Lake McPherson, which was about 7 miles, and 2 or 3 miles up a small stream that flowed into the north end of McPherson, darkness overtook him and he had to camp for the night. He saw tracks afterwards but never gave up the chase. And even though he had to call it off for the night, the strangest, most monstrous part of the story was still to come. According to the article, when he saw the Indians the following spring near Dease Post, he described the animal to them, but they declared it was an Indian devil, had no heart, and couldn't be killed by shooting, had the power of changing into the form of any other animal it chose, and they told a number of tales about its ferocity and endurance. Now, the Indians in that area were very superstitious about it and seldom, if ever, visited that particular locality. They said it was carnivorous and not hibernating, and Dominey did see signs of it during the entire winter while the bears were taking her long sleep under the snow. Never did find out exactly what it was and never was able to see a live one, though he did examine a dead one. Let's talk about the Kokogik. Nathaniel Neacock, the mighty hunter of polar bears, used to scoff at reports about the great Kinnick being seen in the northernmost region of North America. That was according to a story in the Idaho Falls, Idaho Post Register. Story is dated May 15, 1958. According to the story, the Kinnick is the name Eskimos give to a bear they say is too big to come out of the water. And its size seems to vary from story to story. But all agree he's a monster of great size, strength, and appetite. Several weeks before, Neacock laughed so loudly when told Raymond Layla Look had reported seeing a 30-foot bear that clearly Neacock didn't believe it. But Neacock isn't laughing anymore. He's had his own Kinnick encounter. According to Neacock, the Kinnick was grayish-white, and on its head was visible as it swam through the water. And it was so large, he didn't attempt to shoot it. He said the head alone must have been 5 or more feet long and almost as wide. And this wasn't the first time a monster was reported by respected men of the village. Floyd Avakana and Roxy Econo, elders in the Presbyterian Church, and men of undoubted veracity tell of seeing a tremendous sea monster in 1932 while hunting with a third Eskimo. All three thought it was a Kokogik, that's another Eskimo word for the Kinnick, or a ten-legged bear that occupies a prominent role in Eskimo legend. Till now, there have been many scoffers in the village, especially about the Kokogik, and the white man have been known to make reference to the coming tourist season or another abominable snowman. But since the respected Neacock added his testimony, the scoffers are suddenly quiet. Even fearful. You don't even hear much about how the Arctic strains mist distort distances or size or create weird optical illusions. But you do hear and told and retold stories about the Kogogiuk, the ten-legged bear of Eskimo legend. According to the article, stories go something like this. Once upon a time, there was a lazy Eskimo. He was the laziest man in the village. One evening after he'd heard the village hunters tell about their experiences, he went out on the ice. He came to a large hole unless some sea lungs were floating, showing that a large bear had eaten seal, leaving only the lungs behind. Well, the man watched and waited by the hole, and sure enough, the monstrous bear came up. As it started to come out of the ice, he rammed his spear in first one eye and then the other, blinding the bear. But in spite of being blinded, the bear came right out of the water and followed his scent and gave chase. The man ran and ran, dodging among the humps of ice, but he couldn't shake his pursuer. Finally, he saw ahead two towering walls of ice with only a narrow corridor in between them. And he ran through that narrow corridor, but the bear, following close on his heels, was too big and he got stuck and couldn't back out. At that point, the hunter turned around and succeeded in killing the giant ten-legged bear. And a lot of Eskimos, and even some of the non-Eskimos who live in the area still believe there are Kogogiuks out there somewhere in the Arctic vastness. And according to Nathaniel Neacock, a 30-foot polar bear is too big to shoot. Well, let's talk about London's bear monster. Elliot O'Donnell, a renowned collector and investigator of ghost stories, told a story of a strange, ghostly, bear-like creature seen in none other than London, England's Tower of London. According to O'Donnell, Edmund Linthal Swift, appointed in 1814 as Keeper of the Crown Jewels in the Tower of London, refers to an article in Notes and Queries, which is dated 1860, to various unaccountable phenomena happening in the tower during his residence there. He says that one night in the jewel office, one of the sentries was alarmed by a figure like a huge bear coming from underneath the jewel room floor. He said he thrust at it with his bayonet, which, going right through it, stuck in the doorway. So he dropped the rifle and hit the floor in a fit and was carried senseless to the guard room. The next day, Mr. Swift saw the soldier in the guard room. His fellow sentinel was there as well, and the latter testified to having seen his comrade before the alarm, quiet and active and full possession of his faculties. He was now, according to Mr. Swift, changed almost beyond recognition and actually died the next day. Mr. George Offer, in referring to this incident, alludes to queer noises having been heard at the time the figure appeared. Presuming the sentinel was not the victim of hallucination, the question arises as to the kind of a spirit that he saw. Now, the bear, judging by cases that have been brought to light, is by no means an uncommon occult phenomena. Difficulty lies in how to classify it, since upon no question pertaining to the psychic can one dogmatize. To quote from a clever poem that appeared in the January number of the Occult Review, to pretend one knows anything definite about the immaterial world is all swank. At the most, people can only speculate. Nothing whatsoever beyond the bare facts that there are phenomena unaccountable by physical laws is yet to be firmly discovered. All the time and energy and space has been devoted by scientists to the investigation of spiritualism and to make tests and automatic writing are, frankly, futile. No one who's ever really experienced spontaneous ghostly manifestations could for 1 minute believe in the genuineness of the phenomena produced at seances. They've never deceived a lot of people. Many who study them are the opinion spirits can't be convoked to order, either through so-called medium, falling into a so-called trance, table turning, automatic writing, or anything else of that ilk. If a spirit does come, it will come either voluntarily or in obedience to some unknown power. Certainly neither to satisfy the curiosity of a crowd of sensation-loving men and women, or to be analyzed by some cold, calculating, presumptuous professor of physics, whose proper sphere is actually the laboratory. The phenomenon of the Big Bear, provided again it was really objective, may have been the phantasm of some prehistoric creature whose bones lie interred beneath the tower. We all know the Valley of the Thames was infested with giant reptiles and quadrupeds of all kinds. Or it may have been a vice elemental, the phantasm of a human being who lived a purely animal life and whose spirit would naturally take the form most closely resembling it. You know, it's like with a lot of hauntings. The building itself isn't haunted. The land upon which it's built is haunted. So certainly, that the same can be said of the Tower of London, which is a very ancient building. You know, from creatures that may or may not have existed eons ago, let's talk about man-eating plants. The idea there could be monstrous man-eating plant, a beast of an unknown nature lurking in the wilder parts of our planet is not all that implausible. But how about a man-eating plant or a tree? As incredible as it may sound, there is no shortage of reports of flesh-eating flora. In 1878, a German explorer named Karl Lick traveled to the island of Madagascar, where he witnessed nothing less than a human sacrifice to a tree. I saw a movie, oh, good Lord, probably 50 years ago, that dealt with that topic. The horrific details are laid out in a letter that he wrote and sent to the South Australian Register in 1881. According to Leach, the unfortunate victim was a woman of the Makoto tribe who was tied to the terrifying tree. She was actually tied to the tree as a gift to the tree. According to what he wrote, the slender, delicate palpi with the fury of starved serpents quivered a moment over her head, and as if instinct was with demonic intelligence fastened upon her in sudden coils around and around her neck and arms, and while her awful screams and more awful laughter rose wildly, she was strangled down again into a gurgling moan. The tendrils one after the other, like great green serpents with brutal energy, retracted themselves, wrapped her about in fold after fold, until she was no more. Researcher Brent Swanser says that a flesh-devouring tree, it was described as being about 8 feet in height, the appearance reminiscent of a pineapple, 8 long pointed leaves that hung down from its top to the ground. The trunk of the tree was topped with a sort of receptacle that contained a thick liquid said to be soporific qualities that drug potential prey and was believed to be highly addictive. Surrounding this receptacle were long hairy tendrils with 6 white palpi resembling tentacles. The tree possessed white transparent leaves that reminded him of the quivering mouth parts of an insect. Moving on, the American Weekly on January 4th, 1925, included in its pages an article titled Escape from the Embrace of the Man-Eating Tree. It described an encounter in the Philippines in which a man referred to only as Bryant from Mississippi and his native guide came across a truly unusual tree. It was about 35 feet in height and about 90 feet in diameter. Rather ominously, the tree stunk of rotting flesh and a human skull could be seen at its base. Now, it was the curious dimensions which gave it something of a bulbous shape that first caught the attention of the man. It wasn't long before something else grabbed his attention, quite literally. As the man stood and stared at the tree, he realized in his heart it was reaching out toward him. According to the story in the American Weekly, the whole thing had changed shape and was horribly alive and alert. The dull, heavy leaves had sprung from their compact formation and were coming at him from all directions, advancing on the ends of long vine-like stems that stretched across like the necks of innumerable geese, and now that the old man had stopped his screaming, the air was full of hissing sounds. The leaves didn't move straight at their target, but with a graceful side-to-side sway like a cobra about to strike. And from the far side, the distant leaves were peeping and swaying on their journey around the trunk, and even the tree top was bending down to join in the attack. The bending of the trunk was spasmodic and accompanied by sharp cracks. The effects of this advancing and swaying mass of green objects was hypnotic, like the charm movements of the snake. Brian found he couldn't move, though the nearest leaf was about an inch from his face. He could see it was armed with sharp spines in which a liquid was forming. And he saw the heavy leaf curve like a green mittened hand as it brushed his eyebrows in passing. He got the smell of it. That was the same animal smell that hung in the surrounding air. Another instant, and the thing would have had his eyes in its sticky, prickly grasp, but neither his weakness or the brown man's strength threw them both, onto their backs, and that broke the charm. They crawled out of that circle of death and lay panting in the grass while the malignant plant, crackling and hissing, tried its best to get at them. Well, despite the incredible nature of the story, it's important to note it was written for the American Weekly by a very credible source, a botanist and naturalist named Willard Nelson Clute, who was the author of numerous books, including The Useful Plants of the World and The Dictionary of American Plant Names. Maybe the deadly people-eating plant of the Philippines still exists, still luring the unwary into its deadly embrace. And then was the 1881 account of Philip Robinson, who under the Punca wrote of his uncle's near-death experience with a plant hungry for human flesh somewhere along the Nile River. He wrote, "The awful plant that rears its splendid death shade in the central solitude of a Nubian fern forest sickens by its unwholesome humors all vegetation from its immediate vicinity, and feeds upon the wild beast, and in the terror of the chase or the heat of the noon seek the thick shelter of the tree. Or the birds that flitting across the open space come within the charmed circle of its power or innocently refresh themselves from the cups of its great waxen flowers. Or even the unsuspecting man when, though an infrequent play, the savage seeks its asylum in the storm or turns from the harsh foot-wounding sword grass of the glade to pluck the fruit that hanged down from the foliage." And it is very interesting fruit. Glorious golden ovals, great honey drops swelling by their own weight into pear-shaped translucencies. The foliage glistens with a strange dew that all day long drips onto the ground below, nurturing a rank growth of glasses which shoot up in places so high that their spikes of fierce blood-fed green shows far up among the deep tinged foliage of the terrible tree. Do such plants exist? Well, in spite of my wanderings through the jungle, I never saw one, but I heard a lot of stories. Then let's talk about the Montauk Monster. Joe Nichols is a senior research fellow for the Committee for Skeptical Inquiry and Investigative Files columnist for the Skeptical Inquiry. Former stage magician, private investigator, and teacher. He's the author of numerous books, including Inquest on the Shroud of Turin, Panic and Evidence, Unsolved History, Adventures in Paranormal Investigation. According to what he wrote, in July of 2008, the carcass of a creature soon dubbed the Montauk Monster washed ashore near Montauk, Long Island in New York. It sparked such speculation and controversy. Some suggested it was a sealess sea turtle, a dog or other canine, a sheep or a rodent, or even a latex fake or possible mutation experiments from nearby Plum Island Animal Disease Center. Well, the strange saga of the admittedly very weird beast was one that caught the attention of not just national but international media. So it was hardly surprising since the animal appeared to have a beak-like face, large claws, and a dog-like body. While the controversy rolled on for some time and provoked deep rumors about what the government was doing, the answer of the riddle finally came, according to Dr. Darren Nash, who wrote, Is the carcass out of a dog? Dogs have an inflated frontal region that gives them a pronounced bony brow and forehead, and in contrast, the Montauk Monster's head is smoothly convex. As many people have now noticed, there's a much better match, the raccoon Procyon latore. It was the digits of the hands that gave this away. The Montauk carcass has very strange, elongated, almost human-like fingers with short claws. And given we're clearly dealing with a North American carnivoran, raccoon's the obvious choice. And raccoons are well known for having particularly dexterous fingers that lack the sort of interdigital webbing normally found in carnivorans. The match for a raccoon's are perfect once we compare the dentization and proportions. Montauk animals lost its upper canines incisors. And if you're surprised by the length of the Montauk animal limbs, note that, like a lot of mammals, we ordinarily assume to be relatively short-legged, raccoons are actually surprisingly leggy. So you have to ask yourself, is sometimes what we identify as bizarre may actually have a very logical explanation. Well, from creatures in the jungle, let's talk about alligators in the sewers. Maybe the most terrifying of all monsters are those that we know exist. And when they're right under our feet, they become even more fear-inducing. As an example of this, I give you the alligators of New York. We're talking about those immense bone-crunching beasts that lurk deep within the winding sewers and subways beneath the Big Apple. Most people assume the stories of New York's people eating alligators are nothing more than the myth of stuff and legend, but the reality is they are quite real. Now, proof that alligators have been on the loose in the city for decades was provided way back in February 1935 by none other than the New York Times. The story was spelled out in an article entitled, Alligator Found in Uptown Sewer. Use shoveling snow, see the animal churning in icy water. Well, the newspaper noted that a gang of boys led by Salvatore Condolucci actually managed to capture the approximately 7-foot-long animal and beat and stab it to death. They saw it lurking in the sewers on 123rd Street, close to the Harlem River. For more than 30 years, Teddy May was the commissioner of sewers in New York. He'd gone on record as stating he'd heard tales of alligators roaming the sewers of the city as far back as the 1930s. The same time frame which the New York Times reported on the violent encounter at 123rd Street. May conceded he took little interest in the report since he felt it was all a case of folklore legend and certainly not reality. Well, as the reports grew in number, though, he decided enough was enough and it was time for him to take a look for himself at what possibly was going on way below New York. To his amazement and terror, after descending into that darkened, mysterious subterranean realm, he came upon a number of significantly sized alligators swimming in the sewer waters. He quickly realized these stories weren't just stories, and at that point he beat a hasty retreat. Then there's a story of Mark Cherry, a man who maintains that one night in 1966 he was a solitary passenger standing on the platform at 149th Street, Grand Concourse. When he was forcibly grabbed by a pair of police officers who told him there'd been a flooding in one of the tunnels and he had to leave immediately. Well, the somewhat heavy-handed approach of the officers puzzled him. That is, until he caught sight of something as he was being practically frog-marched away from the platform. He said he saw a group of subway employees hauling the body of a large albino alligator out of one of the tunnels, along with the body bag of a type in which a human body would be placed. Significantly, the body bag was clearly not empty. The implication was that the unfortunate soul inside had been attacked and killed by the alligator, which in turn had been killed by the police. Realizing that Cherry now knew what really happened, the officer sternly warned him not to speak of what he'd seen, which he didn't until 2004. It's a good indication of the fear that was drilled into him back in 1966, that he was still concerned 40 years later that somebody in authority might pay him a visit and silence him again. Maybe permanently. Fortunately, nothing so conspiratorial ever occurred. Indeed, taking any kind of territory action against Cherry would only have validated his story. While sightings and claims of alligators in the sewers of New York are nowhere near as prevalent as they were decades ago, the controversy still provokes intrigue and fascination. And just maybe, if we're to believe Mark Cherry, more than a few New Yorkers may have become the victim and the dinner of these huge, vicious alligators. Even El Paso had its alligators. You know, people used to be able to buy them along the roadside as they went to Florida for vacation. And they'd bring them home and they'd keep them as pets till they got big enough to eat the family dog. And then quite often they'd flush them down the commode, which would put them into the sewers. Well, we've come to the end of tonight's show. We've run out of time once again. We'll be back tomorrow night when once again we'll be talking about more creatures of the night.